Hey, how's it going, everybody? We are back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And boy, do I have a special guest for you guys today. Today on the show, we have Mr. Matthew Knowles. Mr. Matthew Knowles is the founder of Music World Entertainment and is known for managing the careers of artists like Beyonce, Destiny's Child, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and more. And he is a speaker and an author and a professor on topics like sales, management, and brand development. And he has authored over 4 different books, which I will link to in the show notes today. And he is a top voice on LinkedIn. So Mr. Matthew Knowles, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing some of your experience with our audience.
Thank you. So Dylan, let's not be formal. Call me Matthew.
All right. I like it. Thank you. All right. So Matthew, I've given a brief introduction, but you have a really exciting background and resume, including being the number one sales guy at Xerox. You're also currently a prolific TV and film producer as well. Anything that I missed, or do you want to give me maybe just a quick walkthrough of your background and some of the highlights as you've achieved this really exciting career?
Yeah, I love to. Like we talk backstage, I love just to have a conversation, nothing planned.
Perfect.
But I grew up in a little small town, Dylan, in Alabama, back in the 50s, early 50s. Always wanted to be a businessman. And as a kid, my parents had day jobs, but they were entrepreneurs, and I'm third generation entrepreneur. So I always had this dream. I used to look at the clouds, and my mother, she really encouraged me that I could do whatever I set my mind to do and to dream and dream really big. And that's what I was a dreamer as a kid. Wanted to be this businessman, wanted to be successful at it. And as it turned out, I spent 20 years in corporate America in sales and marketing. In the medical division of Xerox. I sold copiers for a year at Xerox, but 8 years in the medical division. Was fortunate to be the number one sales rep in the world 3 out of 4 years. And then went on to sell MRI and CT scanners in the early beginnings and ended up as a neurosurgical specialist. And as fate would have it, managed care came into the medical industry, and the neurosurgeon called me to his office and said he couldn't use my instruments because they cost too much. Wow. And that's when I decided I have to find a passion, my passion. And it turned out that Beyonce's group was on Star Search and they had lost. And it turned out that a young rapper in Houston kept asking me to manage him. So I decided to go into the music industry. Went back to school because I think knowledge is power. And the rest is history in the music industry. Have worked with some of the biggest names in the industry. And in the meantime, it's my 22nd year in academia. You know, I teach at Pepperdine, a really unique course this semester called African American Aesthetics Culture from Spirituals to Hip Hop.
Wow.
And then I teach in London at the London College of Contemporary Music. I love to teach and educate and give back. And so that's one of my passions.
I love that. You know, you've kind of prompted several of my questions just in your intro there. But one that I would love to get your take on, I see you're a fellow Greek man. You were in a fraternity when you were in undergraduate, correct?
That's correct. Omega Psi Phi.
I was a Sigma Chi, and it was definitely very formative on my career. I've met a lot of famous and high-profile Sigma Chis along the way. I was wondering if that connection to your brotherhood ever lended any hands up the ladder as you were climbing your career.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I knew some Sigma Chis because I pledged at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Ah,
let's go.
I knew some of your frat brothers, man. Yes, I mean, even David Lombard, who's my fraternity brother, we used to sit when I went to school in Nashville, Tennessee, Fisk University. He was at Vanderbilt, and he was the general manager of the Fisk FM radio station. And I love music. And so we used to sit and talk about one day we're going to have the biggest girl groups, and we were arguing my group is going to be bigger than yours. Well, he went on to put together En Vogue, and I went to put together Destiny's Child. So we both won.
Wow, that's very cool. And you also brought up what I heard in your book today was kind of an inflection point in when you decided to step in as a active father, working with your daughters on managing their careers, but actually move into that role of becoming their manager and becoming part of their professional team. You mentioned in the book that it was actually at the moment in which the group lost at Star Search to a heavy metal band, and you actually went up to Ed McMahon and asked him his advice. And you said, Ed, you know, what advice would you give to parents whose kids are kind of crushed by this opportunity that they lost? You know, what do you do next? And I loved that his advice to you was, for those who lose and go home and implement and make changes, they became successful, like Boys to Men and some other groups. Can you talk about why that was such an important moment and why you decided to then step in a more official capacity in managing your daughter's careers?
Well, you know, you said it absolutely correct. I came down to Orlando. They needed me to help them with the wardrobe because they just knew they were going to win for a month. And literally, Dylan had a separate room just for the wardrobe.
Wow.
So much. So they were crushed. But they were absolutely crushed when they lost. But I had challenged their managers that it was the wrong song. They decided to do a rap song when, you know, we're talking early 90s and little kids, it just wasn't the right time and right place for that. And I'm looking at these kids just crying their hearts out. And I knew how hard and passionate they wanted it. But I also knew that mistakes and failures our life is opportunity. And that opportunity is to grow, and it's not a reason to quit. So I stepped in. We made changes because that's one of the things Ed McMahon said, is that those who lost went back and made those changes. So we made the necessary changes, changed members, eliminated the dancers, things that needed to be done to move forward. And again, at the same time, my fate, as you would have it, is I was transitioning out of corporate America and had this young man in Houston who wanted me to go in management. But I went back to school first, Dylan. I went and took artist management courses. I took publishing courses, production courses, again, because for me, knowledge is power. And I went all across America to every seminar I could to build relationships.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that was going to be another question that I was very interested about doing the research on you, is that, you know, you decided after your time at Xerox when you were going to start doing this officially for the group, as far as being their manager, you actually went back to school and studied. And now today, as you mentioned, you're going on your 22nd year yourself as an educator, teaching in all these different schools. It seems like lifelong learning is a real core principle of how you live your life, both when you were skilling up as a young man, but also now as a professor giving back to the next generation. What is your take on lifelong learning, and how important is that to the audience?
I love how you say lifelong learning, because that's, for me, that is what it is. I mean, the beauty for me, I enjoy exploring. I enjoy challenging. I enjoy discovery and asking the questions why and thinking outside of the box. And to do that, you know, you have to have knowledge. Again, knowledge is the power. So for me, I have always had a thirst for wanting to learn. I'm not that type of professor, and I say it in my class. I always have a second professor in my class, and that's Professor Google. And I always tell my students, Dylan, you don't have to spell it correctly. You don't have to grammatically say it correctly, but Professor Google is here, because if I don't know something, I'm going to be blatantly honest about it and learn with my students. And that's the beauty for me at 72 years old, is to be around these young people that are also have that thirst for knowledge. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, I love that answer. Thank you for that. So this interview is actually very timely for myself. My daughters just started modeling and being in plays and are taking keyboard class or piano classes for the first time. And this has all happened in the last, I'd say, 2 months. My youngest daughter booked her first commercial right out of the gate with a company called Riley & Crew here in San Diego. So I was really excited to ask you the question when I read this quote in People magazine. You mentioned that when Beyonce and Solange showed an interest in music at a very young age, you and your wife Tina at the time, who were already corporate professionals and entrepreneurs, you didn't attempt to downplay their passions. Rather, that you encouraged them, you guided them, and then you supported them. Why do you think so many parents try to steer their children to safe careers when they start expressing interest in the arts and things like that when they're young?
Yeah, that is, wow, that's, we could spend the rest of the interview just talking about that. because, you know, I teach those kids today. I teach those kids who parents wanted them to be something else, something different, doctors, lawyers, you know, attorneys, but that wasn't their passion, and they went and they spent rather time in those areas and really was disappointed because they didn't love what they were doing. And then late in life, they decide, now I'm gonna live my passion. So I teach those students. A lot of my students are just that, where their parents were forcing them to do something that the parent wanted them to be. And that's the mistake that we make. It should not be, you're going to be this when you grow up. It should be, I'm going to give you the tools. I'm going to expose you as a parent to all these beautiful things. We used to take the kids to NASA so they could understand science. We would take them to the skating rink. We would take them to a play, a musical. We would take them to science fairs. We would do all those things and just kind of sit back and notice what they gravitated toward. And it was always music and entertainment. And so we encouraged that. And then we got, put them in dance troupe. We got a vocal coach. We got those things and we sit back to see if they were passionate about it. Because as a parent, how do you know if your kid is a hobby versus a passion? And it's okay that it's a hobby. How do you know that? Which is when you have to tell your child to go to practice, when you have to tell them to go to practice, it's a hobby.
Yeah.
Because when it's a passion, they're going to bug the hell out of you about practices tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I don't want to miss it. I don't want to play.
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting insight. You know, my daughters were in softball before they got interested in the arts. And it was kind of a chore, you know, if it was cold out or if it was a late practice, they'd kind of go hemming and hawing. So they only did a couple of seasons. But now that they're in plays and the arts, like, you know, my daughter last week had a Freaky Friday performance and I was driving her to, you know, practice with her team, you know, till 9 o'clock at night, 3 or 4 days in a row. And two shows on Saturdays, and now she's home sick from school this week with a sore throat and is hoarse, I'm sure, because of, you know, the performance. But it's like you said, like, it takes no cajoling on our part to get them into the car and get them to do the things that they need to do. And they're always in their room rehearsing lines or reading their books or playing songs and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think that's a great advice, because I think for me as a parent, I was very, I wouldn't say hesitant, because I am from the entertainment industry and I know it's possible. And I'm somebody that has enough connections that I might be able to to help them out at some point with my connections. But then at the same time, I didn't want to be looked at as a, you know, dance dad or whatever they call them, you know, somebody who was taking advantage of their kids and trying to force that on them, because that's the world that they come from. So I love the healthy boundaries that you guys set up, where it was really more about encouraging their natural interest and inclination versus trying to force something to happen that wasn't really part of who they were.
And you've heard, Dylan, you've heard parents before say, well, my kid's going to be this when they grow up. You know, we've all heard that numerous times. Oh, by the way, my wife and I, Gina, we lived on Harbor Court in San Diego downtown for 2 years.
Wow.
Between towers downtown.
Yep. I know it well. Yeah. San Diego is a beautiful place to live. You know, California, I love LA. I was there for 10 years. I would never take it. I would never have taken it back. It was where, you know, me and my wife got married and built our life, you know, from that little one bedroom apartment in West Hollywood, myself in the entertainment industry, her in the advertising world. But yes, you can't really beat San Diego when you're ready to start having
It's a beautiful place. And we live now, one of the places we live is Orange County. So,
oh, nice.
You know, yeah. You get to look at the beach and the mountains and the snow caps. It's just amazing.
Yeah, you can, California is the only place where you can go snowboarding, go surfing, and play golf in the same day.
Yeah, and go to the desert.
Right, yeah, exactly. So I wanted to ask you while we're on this topic, and we won't spend, you know, too much on the parenting side, but I wondered if you had, what would be the number one piece of advice that you would give to parents whose kids are kind of contemplating a career in the entertainment industry?
Well, I think the number one thing is really build a team. People that really know what they're doing and have done it at a high level. I think that is really critical. I think starting early, because those that are great in sports and entertainment, they don't wait till they're 17 and 18 to start. I mean, if you just look around, it's probably 6, 7, 8 years old when they started. So it's really important as a parent to help your child identify, regardless what they want to be in life, as early as possible so that you can begin to give them the tools and they can begin to practice and better themselves in their craft.
Yeah, no, I love that. Thank you for that. And last question on that topic, I think somewhere in the book or my research, I remember that you dealt with kind of some hesitation with your daughters around stage fright, even with all the interest that they had in the arts and music, but just kind of getting up in front of a crowd. You know, my youngest daughter loves the idea of being in plays and being in shows, but when it comes to the moments of, you know, having to go up there with her peers, she gets a little bit self-conscious and chickens out. So what is your advice helping a child with that fear of stage fright?
Well, you know, I always say you're supposed to be nervous. That's your body saying to you, gear up. This is important. Gear up. You know, I played college basketball and I would get nervous. You're supposed to get nervous. Again, that's your body telling you, you have to gear up. But it really, Dylan, boils down to the more times you do it, the better and the more comfortable you come. I'm a motivational speaker. I speak all over the world. And I'm comfortable at it because I've done it. You know, there's a book on my shelf back there from Malcolm Gladwell, called Outliers. I'm sure you probably heard of it.
Yeah, it's a great one.
It is. And it says, in order to be great, and he did tons of research, years of research, 10,000 hours. 10,000 hours. So when I look at a Serena Williams or Tiger Woods, Brian or Beyonce, all of them put in 10,000 hours to be great at what they did and what they're doing. So it takes that type of focus and rehearsal and practice, and you just become better and more comfortable the more you do it. So you find places, you know, when I started out managing, I remember one time Destiny's Child was on the back of a trailer truck in a parking lot of Walmart. You know, and you do the little things to just get their confidence level.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that idea of, you know, just doing the reps and putting in the time, putting in the practice. You know, there is no such thing as an overnight success. You know, it's about that repetition. And I think, like you said, Malcolm Gladwell puts it in such an easy, great framework to read in that book. So I would encourage the audience to check that one out if you haven't already. So on that note, I'd like to start moving the conversation around your career as a motivational speaker and a thought leader. So you have a concept in your book called the talk to do ratio. Can you talk a little bit about the talk to do ratio?
Yeah, that comes from my first book that I wrote. You know, I've written five. The DNA of Achievers, 10 Traits of Highly Successful Professionals. And what motivated me to write that book is I fly back then. Gosh, I was flying 5 days a week, sometimes two cities in a day. And, you know, you're sitting there and, you know, as the band got more and more successful, I got to move from coach to first class. And you're sitting there with successful people. And this doesn't happen today, Dylan, because everybody's on their phones listening to music or looking at a movie. But back in the day, you know, you would talk to someone almost a whole flight who was sitting next to you. And the first thing you would ask, what do you do? And man, when you ask that question, the folks that were passionate about it, they would talk to you 2-3 hours about what they do. And I began to think about, and this was a number of times that people did that to me on flights. And I started thinking about my friends that were highly successful. And so I came up with these 10 traits that start with passion. And second, what coexists with that are work ethics. But I also thought about, especially in entertainment, how many times you're in meetings or you're out and about in the marketplace and you see someone in your industry and they say, I'm going to get back with you. I look forward to talking to you. And they never do it. And they never do it. And it just really ig me. And I always come up with these catchphrases. And I was like, talk to do. When you say you're going to do something, what percentage of the time you actually do it?
Yeah, follow through.
Follow up and follow through. And so that's how I came up with talk to do ratio. That's how I judge people, not what they say, but what they do.
Yeah, no, I love that. And, you know, going back to your days at Xerox and, you know, it's funny that we're talking about Xerox, but I think, you know, there's something to be said about being the number one guy at an organization like Xerox that has a very big sales team. And I'm sure you were up against a lot of other competition out there. What do you think it was that made you that number one most successful salesperson within your group?
I realized and understood and share this today that people bought and people buy you first and then you buy. See, a lot of people think they buy your product. No, they buy you. They buy their trust in you. They buy how knowledgeable you are. They buy your talk to do ratio. And then, oh, by the way, what are you selling me? And I understood that. I understood people buy people first and then the product second. Yeah. So I always came with my initial conversation in a different way than most sales and marketing people. I wanted to connect with you. I didn't want to jump into a conversation about my product versus my competition. I wanted to get to know some things. What are some things that we have in common together? How can we have just a conversation first? And those are the things I would always do. I just was very comfortable and very confident in my abilities because I have done the work. I knew my product well. I didn't have to think. Most salespeople are thinking of what they're going to say next versus listening. Number one, another sales skill of a really good salesperson is their ability to listen, not to talk, but to listen.
Yeah, I love that. And I think you illustrated a very important point, which is, you know, business is personal. You know, at the end of the day, you're not selling to a company, you're selling to an individual who has their own needs and wants and, you know, wants to feel like they can trust the person that they're doing business with, that they're going to be, you know, in their corner if anything goes wrong. If it's a vendor relationship and they're going to be spending a lot of time with this person, if it's not a transactional relationship, if it's a partnership, then they're going to be spending time together. And you want to make sure that this is somebody that you're going to enjoy those conversations when you have to pick up the phone or fly to a meeting or something like that together. So yeah, I think as a business development leader in the marketing agency world, I've always tried to do the same thing, which is focus on getting to know people first and let the byproduct of the relationship be the business.
Right. And I tell you something else, Dylan, there's a word that we all know, entrepreneurship. We hear entrepreneurship all the time, but there's a word that we seldom use, and that's intrapreneurship. Mm. And what is intrapreneurship? That's when you run your territory, if you're a salesperson, or you run your department or your division as if it's your company. Mm. And that's a different method that you operate, because entrepreneurship is really just a way of thought. You know, it's how I think as an entrepreneur, as ownership. And so intrapreneurship, I always ran my territory. It was my company. And I would do the same things I would do if it was my company.
Yeah, I love that idea of intrapreneurship. And I think, you know, some salespeople, and I'll maybe, you know, take a hit here, we're so focused on the sale and we're so focused on clients that sometimes we can be, we can maybe not spend as much time focused on internal relationships and the people who actually execute once we do the sales piece. Who's the team around us that's going to execute? And I'm not speaking except for myself, but I know as a salesperson, I need to make sure that I'm saving energy and emotional capital to make sure to build just as good a relationships with my boss, my subordinates, and my vertical teammates in other departments as I am, you know, with customers.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the thing I also had to learn, that relationship with all of the above, customer, people you work with in your organization, those relationships are better built outside of the office. You know, when I sold MRI, now I go from selling, you know, a $200,000 piece of equipment to a $4 million piece of equipment. So I had to deal with radiologists, and I had to learn very quickly that relationship building was really the dinner. The dinner was an important part of what I did in getting to really build this rapport and relationship with folks. That becomes very, very important in sales.
Yeah, and I think also the idea of getting, this isn't as hard, you know, post-COVID, but back when we went to offices, you know, getting people out of their offices, because then they kind of take the guard down. Like when you're in an office, you're kind of your office professional self. But if you can get them out of the office and get them into a nice restaurant or on the golf course or in a cigar lounge, you know, they become they're more their natural selves. And it's easier to build a relationship when you're not in that, you don't have that professional wall up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. All right. So I want to pivot the conversation to go a little bit in the direction of my industry, which is brand partnerships with celebrities, people who built large followings on social media, working with companies and corporations that are trying to leverage the star power of their endorsements and the people out there that they're partnering with. You've obviously had probably one of the biggest front row seats in the history of these types of partnerships with, you know, doing deals with Pepsi and others. Can you talk about what you think is the number one element of making a successful brand partnership between a celebrity, whether that's a musician, athlete, social media personality, and a brand?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, I have had the opportunity with Destiny's Child and Beyonce and Solange and others to do strategic partnerships, McDonald's, one of the Destiny's Child tours, Pepsi, many, many commercials, L'Oreal, many commercials, American Express, Samsung, Nintendo, I can go on and on. So brand development and building a brand and what differentiates you. But let me tell you what I learned very quickly, and it was due to corporate America. So let's say I'm putting out an album on Beyonce, and the record label has a budget, a marketing budget, and let's just throw out a number that the marketing budget is $1 million. But if I partner with L'Oreal, which I did, I can put the song in the commercial. I can put the artist in the commercial. Their marketing budget is $25 million. I understood that very, very, very quick because when I went to the music industry, it was just that. They were in the music industry. I was in the brand name development and endorsement business. I wasn't in the music only business. And when you combine that, and I use that example, L'Oreal versus Sony's budget, but if you combine that, then it's all about sales, is all about numbers. You know, it's a real simple formula. So if I can reach, you know, 50 million people or reach 5 million people, the person that reached the 50 million should sell more. So I understood that in building and brand development and understanding the whole concept coming from corporate America.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that idea. You know, I think sometimes, you know, I think all artists these days more than ever, you know, since the, you know, since the streaming industry has changed music so much, you know, pre-CDs, they had to do more partnerships with brands, maybe from a financial perspective, but maybe there was a little bit of a, you know, antagonistic features there of like selling out or whatever. But I love that idea that, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, or in the case of L'Oreal, 1 + 25 = 26.
Right.
You know,
you're quick on the mat.
You know, still to this day, I have a Coldplay album in my iPhone because of that partnership that they did back in the day, you know, with Apple, or maybe it was U2. It was either U2 or Coldplay. I can't remember which one.
Yeah.
But you know, these brand partnerships, especially if it can fit to organic places like you know, Apple and streaming music, like that seems like a no-brainer to me. So I don't think it's as much of a taboo thing now, but I love that idea of like, I think what I take away from that comment is, you know, look for the win-wins versus the transactional relationships.
But you also said something important, you know, that whole thing about the sellout. It's important that the artist and the team, because that's really who's going to be doing this, is the team. Understand it has to be an organic partnership. In other words, when I went to McDonald's, I was like, hell no, the member of Destiny's Child are not going to be in a McDonald's hamburger french fry commercial. That's not going to happen. So what we did is, what are the commonalities? The commonalities, salad and healthy eating. So McDonald's came out with a salad. The commonality is that McDonald's house, where you have these kids that are struggling and with challenges. So Destiny's Child partnered with McDonald's house. Every city on the world tour, they would go to the McDonald's house. So you have to also make sure that partnership makes sense and is organic rather than monetary, I'm doing this deal just to do a deal. I mean, you're a beautiful woman. It would make sense that you work with L'Oreal. You know, that makes sense. So you have to do things that make sense as well.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think what that shows is, you know, when you are structuring a branded partnership, you need to look at the full available assets of the portfolio company. So I think very smartly you identified, okay, well, what does McDonald's have? We're not going to put them in a Happy Meal, but if they're willing to come alongside our brand values, which is healthy eating and living a good life and nutrition, which McDonald's maybe isn't always known for. So they're lending off your brand equity of having that. And then the charity aspect, the Ronald McDonald's House and doing good. Like who can argue with a partnership where you're helping kids that, you know, need to find a place to live or spend time after recovering from a health crisis, which I think is what that charity is mainly known for. So that's a great perspective. And the stuff maybe sometimes seems like basic when we're thinking about it for marketers, but it's so great to get a refreshing point of view. So thank you for that as well. Another question I had, you know, it seems to me that vertical video, as you think about Instagram Reels, YouTube Shorts, and of course, TikTok, has really completely taken over the way that music is marketed. When you can kind of grab a soundtrack from the internet, as any person just grab something and put it as the background to your music. Seems like artists are being able to launch music and kind of independents are having more success than ever. How critical would you say the advent of vertical video is to marketing music?
Well, very, very important. And you can go back 15 years and hear presentations and speeches that I've said 15 years ago. I was saying it before anybody was thinking that you would see music one day, not just hear it. You would actually see music. And what I meant is exactly what's happening today. Our experience with seeing the music as well as hearing it is so different than if I'm just listening and hearing the sound and audible part of music, because my emotions are different in it. And now I understand what the lyrics are saying, and I get to see the artist in their artistry. And you know, Beyonce shocked the world with coming out with the first, you know, video of all the songs. I mean, we did that back in the early 2000s with both Destiny's Child and Beyonce. We understood the importance of seeing music as well as hearing it. And that's what these streaming platforms are allowing now, is the opportunity of doing both.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that, you know, anybody who's creating a video, instead of having to worry about piracy or any of that kind of stuff, they can just go grab a soundtrack that helps bring the emotion that they want or the vibe or the energy to their little video. On social media, and then the artist gets value because that's free promotion. So again, it's that win-win.
Well, look at what's happening. We were talking earlier about podcasts and the really successful podcasts. 80% of them have video and audio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I think it's 80% of views now are generated for podcasts on video platforms. So people, strangely enough, like I like to listen to podcasts when I'm driving around in the car because it's like kill two birds with one stone. But when I get home at night and I'm ready to shut it off and I go turn on YouTube on the TV, you know, 9 times out of 10, I watch a podcast instead of like, you know, a TV show or something like that.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah. Same pretty here. Cool. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about your experience as a LinkedIn influencer and top voice, because that's becoming a big topic inside of the influencer marketing world. This is being touted as the year that LinkedIn becomes a social media platform. It always has been, but more than ever, it's becoming a social platform. And you were able to achieve that top voice on LinkedIn. Can you tell me a little bit about how that happened? And, you know, what does that do for you as a creator that's out there promoting your thought leadership and the ventures that you're working on?
Well, first of all, it's a real honor to be a top voice on LinkedIn. I mean, to be associated with Richard Branson. I mean, come on. That's a real honor. But I had to put in the work. You know, I didn't start out with this mass number of audience. I had to put in the work. And of all of the platforms, and I have a team that work on social media, but LinkedIn is the one that I actually take the time. I read every comment. I follow up with people. But I had to develop and build that. And it just required work and being committed to it. I wish it was a complicated reason, but it's not. It's just that commitment, personal commitment that I made, that I want to build this platform personally. And I'm going to do the work that's required to build it.
Yeah, that's great. And that's awesome to hear that. You know, I know that there's always a social media platform that creators or people who are thought leaders like don't want to give up. And it's exciting for me to hear that LinkedIn is the one that you won't, you know, hand over the keys of the castle completely to your team. No, and you still enjoy that process.
I do. And if you're listening and then you hit me up on LinkedIn, I'll hit you back.
That's great. Well, the good news is my biggest distribution for this podcast is LinkedIn, that goes out to about 28,000 people. So hopefully you get a little bump from this.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you. I just want to round out the episode with a few questions about some current updates on projects that you're working on. One thing that I was excited to see is that you were awarded the Presidential Lifetime Achievement Award. What was that experience like?
That was a surprise. I didn't know I was going to receive that. I mean, to get a Lifetime Achievement Award with the signature of the President of the United States is a real honor. Mm-hmm. And I hope that the reason I was awarded is because I do the things in the community, especially mm-hmm. in health and wellness, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are areas that I talk a lot about. I'm a cancer survivor myself. I have worked very hard. I had to make a total change once I was diagnosed almost 5 years ago. I had to change my diet. I had to exercise more. I had to reduce stress. I had to do those things required to really be healthy and also emotionally healthy, because mental illness is also a thing. So I talk about these topics and I don't sugarcoat them. Mm. I'm very, very, I share my perspective of them. And I hope that in some way that it's really helped people. And I one of the things about LinkedIn is when I read somebody telling me thank you, the words of encouragements, you know, I go on social media quite a bit with just daily encouragements and share some wisdom and some failures. And I hope those have become helpful for people.
When I was doing the research on you, one of your more viral posts that popped up was one where you were having a Zoom call with a colleague and her little daughter or maybe her granddaughter was in the background playing and kind of maybe making a little bit of noise, not enough to really be a distraction. But, the woman who you were speaking with was maybe a little bit embarrassed and trying to, you know, manage her child who is in the room. And what I loved about that story is, you know, she shared with you that she's, you know, somewhat interested in the arts. And instead of, that being an awkward situation, you encouraged her to bring her little girl up to the screen to actually interact with you and, you know, give her a little bit of advice and encouragement and, you know, the things that she's going after and her goals. So that was really cool.
Yeah, that's just who I am. I mean, what you see is what you get all the time.
That's great. Well, as in pertaining to the award, we didn't go through the numerous list of awards and boards that you serve on from a nonprofit capacity. I would encourage those of you who are interested to look up Mr. Knowles on LinkedIn and see of all those things and to see some of the organizations that he supports, because there are many. And I'm sure that that was a large component of what drove your consideration and ultimately the award that you received from the president. So congratulations again on that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And by the way, If anyone wants to know what I'm doing and get a complete overview, I suggest they just go to MatthewKnowles.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they can book me to speak there, because that's what I'm passionate about. It's just educating and motivating people and entrepreneurship and sales, marketing, and other areas.
Yeah, no, I love that. Well, I'll definitely link to that in the show notes. I just noticed that we hit the 45-minute mark. So anything else that you'd like to leave our audience with today, or how to find you, or any other calls to action?
No, I think they can get it all on MatthewKnowles.com. It's pretty robust. But I've enjoyed the opportunity, Dylan. I hope we have the opportunity to talk again. We have a few more minutes if you'd like to expand. But, moving into the area of film and TV, we have a number of projects coming out that we're working on. And the film and TV industry takes a lot longer than the music industry. And I've had to adjust to that. What wasn't easy for me to adjust to. I could put out an album in a year, but I have to wait 4 or 5 years before I can put out a movie. But we're at that point now. The strike is over. And so we're working on a number of projects that we'll be announcing soon. Enjoying the film and TV area, you know, we were fortunate to have done numerous soundtracks over the years. And so we had some experience in Beyonce and Solange. They've been in many, many movies and TV shows and other members of Destiny's Child. So you'll be hearing more about Destiny's Child coming up soon, not a tour. I don't want everybody to go crazy and say that, but there'll be other projects coming out, documentary and other things that will be happening in the next year.
Yeah, I think I read in Variety that there's actually a biopic being written or is in development around your life story.
There is, the Matthew Knowles story, which, it has had its lot of ups, but it's had downs also. So we're sharing that, again, growing up in Alabama in the 50s and I never went to a black school until my junior year of college.
Wow.
And my mother went to high school with Coretta King in Marion, Alabama. So There was a lot of things that I would share that molded me as to who I am today that happened during those formative years growing up in Alabama. The age of segregation.
Well, I didn't get to read that book yet. That's on my list. I wanted to focus on the business components of the story, but my understanding is that the biopic is actually based on your memoir. So I'm excited to dig in with that one as well, so I can learn a little bit more about that history, because I think it'll be eye-opening.
Well, thank you, Dylan. You're a good man.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it, sir. So for those of you at home, thank you so much for tuning into this edition of the Ad Podcast. If you enjoyed my conversation with Mr. Knowles today, please go ahead and give this show a 5-star review on Apple, iTunes, YouTube, wherever you're happening to watch it. If you subscribe or follow us, that'd be great. You'll get access to additional future episodes. And finally, last but not least, if you enjoyed the conversation that I had with Matthew today, don't forget to share this episode with a colleague or a friend who might enjoy our conversation. So with that, Matthew, I'll let you get back to your day, recover. I know you've had a long one, but I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
All right. I'll see you soon.
All right. Thank you.